Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Can everyone hear me okay? Perfect. Let me just get my timers running here so I don't go over. Okay, so you guys are in the Practical HTML5 talk. For better or for worse, you're here now. The doors are locked from the outside, so you can't get out. My name is Matthew Osborne. A little bit about me. I came to Microsoft after working in the engineer in the field for about 6 months after college. I came to Microsoft. I worked on all the MVCs, so basically MVC 1, 2, 3, and 4. I worked on NuGet a little bit, so we'll see NuGet a little bit. I do enjoy talking about NuGet, so if anyone wants to know more, find me after. We'll talk for a while. You can buy me a beer, because I like beer too. So I snuck that in there. And then after Microsoft, I left. I now work at a small cloud startup-ish. Small-ish company called Tier 3, who provides some infrastructure as a service type thing. So that's a little bit about me. I enjoy giving this talk simply because when I very first started using HTML5, I got a lot of pushback from a lot of people saying, we can't use this, it's not a ratified spec. If you know anything about this, this isn't slated to really be ratified as a full spec for several years from now. I think 5 or 6 years now is the current. There's been a lot of working drafts. They've got basically what it's going to be, but you know, as any big organization, will take forever to finally finalize on the spec. So there was a lot of pushback about being able to use these things. And in this talk, we're going to talk a little bit about how you can go from using these things now, and then all the you're going to kind of see some of the pitfalls that you're going to run into, and you know, how those manifest, and then we're going to show you how you can work around those so you can actually leave today. My goal is at the end of this talk, you can actually go home, go to your pet project, go to your company, and start using some of the stuff I'm going to show you without having to worry about, is it going to be supported in all the different browsers? The last caveat before we begin is that I'm going to say HTML5 a lot in this talk, and that's because it's a lot easier to say than HTML5, CSS3, and the new JavaScript, right? That's really what we're going to talk about, is all three of those specs together. They kind of all go together. You don't use one without the other, typically speaking, right? You're not going to do some new element with probably not venturing into CSS3. You're probably not going to do that. You're probably not going to take advantage of either ones without using JavaScript. So quite frequently, this is used as an umbrella term. So we're going to keep it that way. We're going to use it as an umbrella term. If you have any questions specifically about which part I'm talking about, whether it's in the HTML spec, CSS spec, or anything like that, I'd be glad to answer those. And also, if you have any questions, I'll definitely try to leave some time at the end. But if you're just completely lost, raise your hand. If not, ask me at the end. We'll try to get in as much as we can. So the first part to this is you really need to know what is HTML5. So what's HTML5, CSS3, the new JavaScript? What is it before we can talk about why you should use it or even its practicality, right? So how many of you are familiar with HTML5? So everyone's probably heard about it. Is anyone using it in their day-to-day job or anything like that? Good. I get to show a lot of cool stuff. And hopefully you guys will be blown away. So the first part is there's kind of three things. And the first part is this is a new standard for a new web, right? So when the HTML4 spec, which is the thing you guys are probably all familiar with, you've heard of a span tag, you've heard of a div tag, you've heard of blink or marquee, heaven forbid, or anything like that, you've heard of those tags. Those were created a very long time ago. And I say a very long time ago, but realistically, it wasn't that long ago. It's just really long in computer terms, right? Everyone knows a couple years is decades in computer terms. So what happened is as the internet and the infrastructure around the internet got better, we had to work around a spec, right? So when HTML4 and CSS2 were designed, no one had any idea that I could be in the middle of a lake on a boat with my laptop tethered to my cell phone and streaming every camera angle from the Olympics halfway around the world, right? No one thought that was going to be possible. There wasn't even the infrastructure to make that possible. And as it grew, these things, we said, hey, we could do these really cool things, but the spec is limiting us. So we developed things like Flash and Silverlight, right? That's effectively circumventing a spec. It's defining its own spec, and it's installing things on both endpoints and saying, these two things know how to talk to each other. I'm going to define my own spec. Forget about everything else you know about HTML, right? That's kind of annoying. No one likes installing plugins. It seems like every time I start my browser, I get bugged about Flash needs to update or Silverlight needs to update or anything like that. So it's really annoying. So the W3 sat down and said, okay, if we're going to spend the time to do this, we're going to do it right. We need to think forward, and we need to think about as much as possible. And we're going to create a spec for the new web, right? That's why I say it's a new web. No one had any idea that these things were going to exist at the time the other ones were created. So the three parts that make up this new standard, there's kind of three. The first and most simplest is new elements, right? Everyone's familiar with divs and spans. Well, now there's a few extra that you can start using. You can use things like the footer, the article, the section tag, the H group, the aside. We're going to talk about some of these, and I'm going to show you how to use some of these. But these are just the new elements. They provide a little bit more semantics to your HTML instead of just having a generic span tag. The second of the three is things that provide new functionality. Right? So there's not necessarily an element in your markup associated with them, but they're going to provide some extra functionality. So things like WebSockets, we're going to show a little bit of WebSockets. Box shadows, keyframes for animations, you're going to see some animations. The new storage API, the new file API that allows you to access files on the computer in a kind of sandboxed way, but you can manipulate some files. So there's these new functionality pieces as well. And the third is obviously crossover pieces, so things that cross over in between elements and functionality. So those everyone's probably the thing that's probably got the biggest, you know, hoopla around HTML5 is audio and video tag, right? That's a new element. It goes in your markup, has a visual representation, and it also provides some functionality, right? So you can play video, you can play audio, those types of things. There's things like the progress. There's things like a timer element, and one of my favorites that doesn't get used as much, isn't quite as widely adopted yet, is validation. Validation is pretty awesome because, I don't know about you, but I really hate having to wire up. Every time I wire up jQuery to make sure a field is required, I die a little bit on the inside. Like, it's the simplest thing that a browser could do for you. So, you know, that's something where it also has a visual representation, but it also has functionality as well. So those are the three pieces that make up HTML5 and CSS3 and JavaScript. So let's talk a little bit about why. Why do you care? Now that you know what they are, why do you care about them? More than, how many of you have been working on a site or know somebody and all of a sudden HTML5 came out and all your requirements said, this site has to be HTML5 compliant or CSS3 compliant, right? It's a new hip trend. It's the new web 2.0. Everyone wants their site to be HTML5, right? Well, there's more to that than just marketing hype. There's a reason. You might not understand it yet, but that's why hopefully you guys are all here, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. So I like to break down the why into three parts. Okay, I call them the three S's. It's a little gimmicky, but I call it smaller, simpler, and more semantic. So these are the things that this is going to do for the stuff that you write, so the code you write, right, or the website you maintain. It's going to do these things, right? So the first S is smaller. So don't worry if you can't read in the back. It's intentionally done really small because I wanted you to see how much code it took. So on this side of the screen, you have the old way. And there's going to be a couple slides. So on your guys' left side is the old way of doing it. On the right side, you know, the right way is on the right. Okay. This is a very simple example of putting rounded corners on an element. Everyone's done the web 2.0 thing where everything had to be rounded. Everything had to have a bubble-like feel, right? Consequently, it's kind of circled around. Everything's metro now and squared off, and it's cyclical. I'm just waiting for web 4.0, and it's going back to all bubbly and roundy again. It'll eventually get there. So what it would take is a lot of markup. You would have to put in a couple placeholder divs that represented the top right, top left, bottom right, bottom left, and then you'd put an image inside of there that was the rounded corner that you wanted. You'd set the CSS so it positioned it right in the corner. You'd move on. You had your rounded corners. You were good to go. You might be saying to yourself, well, there's JavaScript plugins, or I used a JavaScript plugin at one time or another to do this for me. Effectively, underneath the covers, all the JavaScript plugins were doing was this. They were looking at the background. They were creating an inline image for you in JavaScript and rendering it out. So it's effectively the same thing, but you didn't have to maintain the code. That's about 47 lines worth of code that is now on your application or program every time that you want to do a rounded corner, right? And there's four lines of extra markup, so four extra divs that you didn't need that are now in your thing every time you wanted to have a rounded corner in an element. So if you think about Web 2.0 and everything's rounded, that adds up, right? You might have 60, 70 elements that are not actually needed. They're there just for styling. That's going to add up. It's going to make your download speeds slower. It's going to make, once it's down on the computer, it's going to affect how the browser renders things, right? Has to parse those elements, has to understand that's more rendering time, right? On the right side of the screen, you'll see how to do it in HTML5. It's about 9 lines of code. It's a little exaggerated. Probably doesn't need to be that much. But it's simply a border radius. There's a CSS3 property that says, hey, you probably wanted a little rounded corner on this thing. We went ahead and added it. I find it funny that once border radius was added, everything went back to the square metro look. So we finally got something to make it easier, and now we're back to square, of course, because it wasn't hard. So we can't charge as much money for it. No, you don't. That's true. You need one. The second S, so that's smaller. Everyone can agree that one side was a lot bigger than the other of the bar graph, right? One took up the entire screen. The second S is simpler, right? So what I have here on the screen, once again, wrong way to do it, right way to do it, is an example of how to do a watermark text box. Everyone's probably seen one of these before. Some of you might have had to implement them before. It's basically a little text box, and instead of putting the label next to it, you put the text inside of it. It's kind of grayed out. It says, put your username here, your password here, yada, yada, yada. It's kind of a design element. And when you tab into it, it gets cleared out. You type something into it. You know what to type there, right? In this particular example, what I'm doing is I'm grabbing each HTML on load for the page. I would grab each input, so each text box. I would look at the title attribute, which is what I wanted to use for the placeholder. And then I would stick that as the value of the text box and apply a class that would make it look grayed out, right? So that's the easy part. The tricky part is when a user interacts with that text box, right? So when a user tabs into it or clicks on it, however they get into it, so on focus of that text box, I would then have to remove that value, remove that class, right, and let them type. Once they left, so however they got out, they tabbed out, they clicked around, they did something else, I would have to inspect the value of that text box and say, did they put something there? If they did, leave it be. Don't do anything. Or if they didn't, if it's empty or they just put spaces or anything like that, I'm going to go ahead and actually add the value back and the class back to get that watermark. So as you're tabbing through the fields, all the watermarks don't disappear. And in a funny enough example, I've had this slide for about 6 months or so, and I actually just noticed there's a bug. So in this case, I'm not checking for space. So if you were to tab in and press space, you didn't do anything, and tab out, you wouldn't get the watermark back. So you'd have no idea what that was, what you were supposed to type in there. But that's a good illustration of this is 5 code paths. So maintaining this, you have to test now 5 different code paths of something you want to do, right? The right way to do it, on the right side, is in HTML5, there's an attribute you can place on an input element called placeholder. You put it there, you put the text in there, the browser handles everything else. It's effectively one code path. You could argue that it's 0 code paths because the browser was parsing it already. Putting 0 seems kind of unfair. It's not a good comparison. You can't compare it quite as much. So. That's the second S. That's how it's going to make it simpler. Pardon me as I spill water. The third S is more semantic. So I want to pause and talk a little bit about why you care if it's more semantic. Right? Effectively, what you guys are writing is some piece of code, some text that is going to be interpreted by a computer, a robot, right? That robot is either going to be a browser that's going to want to do something with it, it's going to be a search engine bot, something like that. Or, in the case of accessibility, it's going to be a screen reader that's also looking at the browser and saying, what does this HTML mean so I can read it out to, you know, somebody that has a disability, either they're blind, low vision, those types of things, right? Or impaired in some way. So effectively, what you're writing is something that a browser or a robot has to interpret. So the more semantics that you can embed in that same amount, the easier it's going to be for those things to understand what you, the human, originally meant, right? In this example, this is a very simple example of just a, it's a regular page with a little blog post type example. It's the standard blog post example, except it's a really lousy blog because it only has one post and it's called some content. But in this example, if I was a robot looking at this, you can see I have a header and a nav defined at the very top. You can read that because you understand that class, you read the word header, you understand what it means. You read the word nav, you understand what it means. You can quickly parse the whole document, realize there's no other header or no other nav defined on the document. So that's probably the header of the document. That's probably the navigation that you're supposed to use, right? Robots don't know that. The browser doesn't know that. It can't render some default style for you because there was no standard way of doing this. People would sometimes put a class, sometimes an ID, sometimes they were more cryptic. It was like page dash header, content dash header. There was all of these cryptic ways of doing it, and it made sense to you as you were parsing it. The developer was writing it out, could understand, but the robots would have a really hard time understanding what you meant. Then there is a blog post, right? A blog post is really an article that you've manufactured and put on the internet, right? It's a self-contained piece of information. Just like a newspaper article, everyone remembers what a newspaper is, right? They haven't completely died. Just like a newspaper article, you can clip that out and hang it on a fridge, right? And it's going to make sense, for the most part, outside the context of having to know what date or what newspaper it came from, right? Makes sense. It's a self-contained story. That's what a post is. There's no way to say that this post is self-contained in HTML4. Other than wrapping it in some kind of div or a paragraph tag, there was no way to say that this is a self-contained element, a story. Lastly, I have a little spot here. I want to make some money, so I threw an ad on my page here. If a robot looks at this, it has no idea that this ad is something else, right? As far as it's concerned, that content, whatever is inside there, is related to everything else on the page. So if you're using a browser or, you do this and a search engine, a very dumb search engine perhaps, goes through and reads it, it might say, oh, this ad is also related to this. I'm going to somehow index these two things together. So all of a sudden, I've got an ad for a video game that's now, impeding my search results, right? So here is how to fix these things. This is the HTML5 way of doing it. We've used some of the new elements. So you can see at the top, we've fixed the mixed class and ID problem. We're now using the semantic header and navigation. The browser can understand those elements and say, hey, I found this. It's here. This is the only one on the page. This is the header, right? And there's some rules for when you can include the header tag. You can only have one on a page, and you can only have one in a section. Navigation. The browser can now understand, hey, this is the navigation of the site. And a screen reader can now understand, this is the main navigation for the entire website. So as you're using an accessibility tool, instead of giving them a bad experience where they have to tab through every single thing on the page to get back to your navigation, or you have to put some rel attribute so the screen readers know how to jump back up to the navigation, you've simply done it by just changing the element that you already had there. You're using another element. Portability. The article is now in an article tag, right? That makes sense. They created that for self-contained stories. If any of you have an iOS device or have used a different, there's a couple different plugins for Chrome, Firefox, those types of things, where you click on a website and you put it in readability mode, and it basically pulls out a bunch of text and puts it on a black and white, nice, easy to read screen without anything around it, without any other styling from the site. Those things often just look for article tags on the page and pull them out and show you them in reading mode, right? Because that's what it is. It says, hey, this is something that can be pulled completely out and shown, and it's going to make sense to the user, right? It's a self-contained story. So that's why you would want to do something like that. And then lastly is the aside, which means that while it is a sibling in the DOM, so while it's right next to the article, this ad is completely unrelated to that article above it. That's what the aside is. It's a term brought over from print media saying that this is the aside to a magazine article or a newspaper article, something like that. Right? So that's completely separate. So that's the three S's. So it's going to make it smaller, simpler, and more semantic. So we're going to jump into some demos. Before I start, does anyone have any questions? Okay, everyone's either baffled at how awesome I am, or you are all still asleep from lunch. Okay, sorry about that. First thing is, all this code I'm going to be writing is going to be in ASP.NET. Most of it's going to be in ASP.NET MVC. That's simply just an artifact of that's what I'm familiar with. I worked on the MVC framework. I know how it works. I know the ins and outs. It's just easier for me to write websites in this. I could have chose PHP, Node, choose your framework of choice. So long as it's using HTML at some point and it's getting sent to a browser, you can probably use what I'm going to show you. But in this case, I'm just choosing to use this for my ease. Also, if we're showing anything and you're wondering, is that specific to the framework or is that HTML, don't be afraid to raise your hand. I don't know how many of you, use ASP.NET versus PHP versus, choose your framework, but I'm glad to answer any of those questions as well. So let me just go ahead and run this real quick so you guys can see what this is. This is a simple podcast site. It's pretty just basic styling just so I could get off with the demo. And I'm actually going to switch from Chrome to IE. It's not because I think IE is more superior or not. I don't want to have that holy war. It's just that IE has built-in tools that allow me to switch the user agent so I can show you what it's like to render in a down-level browser. If you didn't know that that was possible, if you're in IE, press F12, you get the developer tools brought up. And that's going to allow you to inspect the page, see what's going on, and it's also going to allow you to change the browser. So there's two here. Some people get a little confused with what these two mean. Most of the time, you're going to want to change both so they match. The browser mode is what you identify yourself as to the server as. So when I make a request to the server, this browser is saying it's an IE10 mode. If I was to change it to IE8, it would say, hey, I'm an IE8 browser. The document mode is what internally, what rendering engine will be used to render the HTML after we've got it back from the server. So it depends on how, most of the time you're going to want to change both because you're going to want to identify yourself, especially as we talk a little bit about graceful down-level experiences, you're going to want to identify yourself as that and then also render as that. But you can do either or if you choose. So I've got this site, pretty easy, pretty simple, just a podcast site. So let's go ahead and change it and use some of the new elements that we've learned about. Also, as you see some code commented out, try not to jump ahead. We'll get to all the commented out code. So the first thing, this is pretty easy. This is the header tag. I was using the standard ID to identify this as the header. Well, now we've already seen it. There's a new header attribute. I'm going to pause. I can't believe it took the Visual Studio team this long to do this. But as I was changing the opening tag, if you look below, the closing tag is also changing. I can't believe it took them that long to do that. Every other ID on the face of this earth did that. But they finally got there, so yay them. So that's the header. You can see here that we've got this menu container. That's probably going to be the navigation. If I was going to go out on a limb, I'm going to go ahead and say that's navigation. And then we have a footer down here. I'm going to go ahead and change this to footer. Right, that one's pretty simple. Let's see what we can do to clean up the index page, which is just the default page that we were looking at. Well, this guy represents that blue box that was at the top. That's really kind of a call out. It's a hero. Everyone's kind of familiar with that. I think that that's kind of a self-contained piece. So I'm going to use a new tag that you may or may not have seen, which is called the section tag. So I want to pause here, because there's a lot of these new container tags. We've talked about the article, the section, the div already. Right? So there's three that we've already talked about. An article tag is completely self-contained, right? You can cut it out, paste it on the fridge, it would make sense. A section tag, think of it more as a chapter in a book. It's a self-contained piece of the story, but it's not the whole story, right? So one problem I see is I go around and talk to people and they say, oh yeah, I'm using HTML5, you look at it, is they've gone into their site, everywhere that they're using a div, they've changed it to a section and said, I'm using HTML5, congrats me, pat on the back, I should get a bonus this year. Well, that's not really true. You're actually probably making it worse because you've said each one of these is now a self-contained chapter in the story. That's probably not what you meant for the most part. It's okay to have a lot of them, books have a lot of chapters, but it's probably not what you were actually meaning if you changed every single div to be a section, or every single div to be an article. That's probably not what you meant either. So don't just blindly come in here and start changing them as I've shown you here, and you're going, oh, I'm doing great. So be conscious about what you change. Lastly, I kind of have this title-subtitle relationship. There's a new tag to help define that. So if you were looking at this, if a browser was parsing this, it would see the header 1 tag and the header 2 tag and say, okay, this is the header 1, this is the header 2, and it would move on. It would create no relationship to them, right? There is a relationship because it's a title-subtitle. Just like a book has a subtitle, this section has a subtitle, this chapter has a subtitle, has a title and a subtitle. So I'm going to use the new tag, which is called an H group. And the H group is a pretty strict tag. There's only a few places that you can actually use this. Control-KD, let me format that. There's only a few places that you can use this, which is it can be at most and only two, right? So it has to have two header tags. Can't have one, can't have three. It's only two. And it can only have header tags. It is to define the relationship between a title and a subtitle. It can be an H3 and an H4. It could be an H5 and an H6. Doesn't matter, but it has to define a relationship between the two. So we've got the H group there. And I think that's good, except I forgot one part. I'm still using the HTML4 doc type. Right? How many of you have this memorized? Because you're way better than me. Yeah, no one memorizes this big, long, nasty URL. It's pretty horrible. I don't know why anyone created that long, nasty URL. So the good news is this is a lot easier in HTML5. The HTML5 doc type is that, doctype HTML. Now, strictly speaking, this isn't the HTML5 doc type. It's give me whatever the latest version of the spec you have is. In this particular case, there's not going to be an HTML5 version for a long time, right? But if HTML6 was to come out tomorrow, this would be the HTML6 doc type, provided they stuck with what they said they were going to do. There is a specific way to go in here and define, I actually mean HTML5, and you get a big, longer, nasty URL like you did before, but you don't have to. This is just give me the latest. It understands what that means. So along with this, also, once again, something that took them forever, but it's finally there. You notice as I changed the doc type on the page, the doc type and the validation actually changed in Visual Studio. So if anyone's using Visual Studio, you used to have to go click and change the validation mode. Even though it was parsing the document and it would realize there was a doc tag and it would validate the doc tag until it was right or wrong, they didn't actually spend the time to go change it. Now it changes. So that's kind of a helpful tool. Last but not least, I'm going to put an XML namespace. And everyone's going to boo at me because no one likes XML. But I'm going to put an XML namespace here. If you just pardon me for 1 second while I type it out. One more nine. Except that's XHTML. So what defining an XML namespace does here is means that this browser, or that this parsing mode is now XHTML5, right? It's XHTML. So what is XHTML? It is just a version of HTML that's more strict. It means that your HTML is also valid XML, right? I don't know why you would want to do this, maybe mainly because you're a masochist and for some reason you're going to ignore all the open source HTML parsers out there and you want to use an XML parser to read your HTML. Long time ago, this made a lot of sense because really the only thing out there to parse HTML was XML parsers. So you would put this on here, you would make sure it's validated, it would always be valid. Now, I'm not a huge fan of it. Really, most of the time, the way it's going to manifest itself, and you're going to see, is the big difference is that if you have an attribute, you must also have a value. So the HTML5 spec specifically calls out attributes that are just flags. If you put controls on an audio tag, that means that the controls now show up and you get it. But if you want it to be XHTML compliant, you have to put controls equals something. And the standard way of doing that is controls equals the attribute name again, so it would be controls equals controls. That's the way it's going to manifest itself most of the time. You can choose to do this or not. I'm not going to sit here and have a religious argument whether we should do it or not. So I've got all of that. Any questions? Everyone good? Okay. Let's go ahead and render this guy. So I'm in IE10. You can see it's basically looking almost the same in IE10, right? Should. Everything's the same. I just changed some tags. So what happens if I move this to IE8? Well, everything's going to break because everyone knows IE8 had many bugs, but everything's broken. So this is kind of the first pitfall that we're going to run into. And this is the one I'm going to spend the most time on because I want you guys to understand what's going on. A long time ago, when IE8 was created, there was a set list of elements that it knew about, right? So the spec defined a certain list of elements or DOM nodes that could be in the HTML. And when it was doing its parsing, if it wasn't in the list of known HTML elements, it would mark it as self-closing and it would move on. So if I come in here and I expect this, you can see that the section tag, I'm not wrapping all of this stuff in the section tag anymore. It's just marked as self-closing and it moved on. And this was done for performance reasons, because it didn't have to go forward in the document and see, hey, is this tag exists later on in the document? It would just mark it as self-closing, because the self-closing tag isn't going to have really any visual representation. It's going to move on, right? But that's why we got everything kind of blown out of proportion, is it's nothing's in the right tags, and we've got a bunch of styles based on having those there. Well, luckily, some people much smarter than myself figured out a way to cheat the system. They figured out a way how to game and get the browser to recognize these tags. The way that you do that is in JavaScript, you have the ability to do a document.createElement. This is going to create a node, a DOM node, of this type, whatever text you put in here. Early browsers would say, oh, you added a header tag, I'm now going to add that to the list of known types. So then from whenever you added it, from then on, when it would parse a document, it would know about the header tag, or it would know about the foo tag. Whatever text you put in there, it would know about. In this particular case, since it doesn't know about all these HTML5 tags, I'm going to tell them about all the HTML5 tags. I'm not going to do anything with the nodes. I'm just going to create them and forget about them. Normally, you would set it and put it somewhere in the DOM, but in this case, I'm just forgetting about it. Doesn't need to be in the DOM to be represented. And you would continue on with any of the other elements that you possibly needed to know, right? So there's several more elements. I just chose not to show them all, just doing the ones that I thought were important for this talk. So if I go ahead and run this guy, come back over here. I keep doing that. I've got the Chrome shortcuts memorized, muscle memory. I got to switch back to IE. So you can see now we have something that's actually a lot worse, in my opinion. The styles look really messed up. It's okay. I didn't screw up my demo yet. That's what it's supposed to look like. But if we come in here and we're going to inspect the DOM and kind of see what's going on, let's click on this guy. You can see that the DOM is now represented correctly. The section tags are in the section place. Everything's nested correctly in the right thing. You guys probably want this. There we go. Let me minify. Sorry about that. You guys probably care about this. Now it's probably a lot easier for you guys to see. The section's in the right spot. The H group is now containing everything the right way. So what's going on? Why on earth is the styles messed up? Well, the styles are based on the default behavior, right? So every element inside of an HTML document has a default style, right? That's why if you don't put any styling on anything, you get something that looks halfway decent. The HTML5 spec defines these elements as block elements, but when you do this document.create, it uses the default style in IE8. The default style in IE8 was an inline element. So all the styles kind of get screwed up. That's a simple fix. Once you know what that is, it's a simple fix. So we're going to come back here, and we're going to look at my content site. And I've already got some commented out code here. We're going to put those back. I'm just resetting them all to block. I'm going to come back here, run this guy, and you can now see that I've got basically back to the same thing that I had in IE10. Right? So I've gone from using the new elements, seeing the problem, understanding the problem, and then solving it in a way that you could do all the time. Right? Every site you might end up doing this. The only difference that you're going to run into is everyone is probably familiar with the box model problem. If you're not, don't worry. It just deals with how padding and width is handled, along with margins. It differs between browser implementations. And that's pretty much the only difference that you're going to run into. But if you're supporting IE8 anyways, you've probably run into this. You've probably already implemented one of the hundreds of workarounds to fix that. So in this case, you're going to look basically the same if I keep switching back and forth. Any questions so far? Nope, doing good. Okay, so you've now seen the basic element stuff. So we're going to skip forward a little bit, and we're going to show you some CSS stuff, right? So the CSS stuff is kind of what makes things look pretty. So let's make something look pretty. So what I have here, this is a purely giving myself the benefit here. When this comes up, this is a local copy of my website. URL's at the end because I know you guys are all dying to go read my website. But what I have here is a website, and I've got a lot of content. This is great. I've spent some time styling it. It's using all the new stuff that we were talking about, the header, the section, the tag. Also, if you notice, this is basically the default template you get in the new ASP.NET version. So when you say file new website, this is what you get. It's because I'm the guy that wrote that, so I stole it from my website. I felt like it was fair. But let's talk about kind of some down-level experiences, because that's the next thing. We've already been talking a little bit about it with IE8. That's a down-level browser. I know that's maybe a negative term, but it is. It's an older browser. One of the more popular down-level browsers or things that you might consider is one of these. It's a phone, right, or a tablet. That's a small screen. That's down-level, if you will. It's not a full-fledged computer. So what happens if I take this and I make this really small? Well, my site kind of looks like crap, if you will. It's got a lot of space. I've now increased the amount that the guy has to sit there and scroll through on their thumb a lot, right? Your thumb's going to get tired just trying to get to the end of the page here. I've got a lot of spacing here. My menu is kind of all weird looking. It doesn't look very good. These images, which were just some nice eye candy, don't really need to be there. They don't add anything to the site. So let's try to fix some of those problems with some down-level features. So we're going to use a feature called Media Queries. This is something new that's in CSS 3. It's one of the modules in CSS 3. This allows you to ask questions about the browser and apply styles based on those questions. So I'm just going to insert the media snippet here. What this is you do @media, and then you start adding on these queries, and you type and in between. In this particular case, I'm using only screen. For those that didn't know, style sheets, when you link to a style sheet, so when you put the link rel, style sheet, all of that, you can define when they apply. So if you want the screen one, you can do one for the screen. And then you can also define the one that I find most handy is the print. So then when a user goes to print your website, you can remove all the images. You can remove some of the cruff around the Chrome around your website. So you get this nice little page that they can view it and read and make it a little bit easier. In this particular case, I'm saying I only want this to happen when it's on the screen. So these won't apply if the user tries to print it. And I'm giving it a max width. So let's go ahead and say, I don't know, anytime that it's smaller than 900 pixels, and I could do a height. I don't care about the height, so I'm going to get rid of that. What this means is any style that I place inside of here is only going to apply if these conditions are true. Right? So once the browser gets wider than 900 pixels, this style isn't going to apply anymore. And I've chose to do this at the bottom because of that. Right? So I'm going to override some styles that were above based on whether these styles apply or not. So the simplest one to show you, if I could actually type, is a background. I'm just going to change the background here to red. Also, that's a cool little Visual Studio feature if you want. Gives you a color picker now, finally. So if I Alt-Tab back over to this guy, and it's only going to show up because of the markup at the top. But if I go ahead and refresh the page, you can now see that the background has switched to this red, pinkish color. And the second that I make it wider, the background changed. So that's not very good. Like, I'm not going to just change the background color. So what can we do to improve that? Now that we understand how we can apply styles for these down-level browsers, these smaller browsers, what can we do to make this better? Well, I think we can remove some of this stuff that's just what I like to call Chrome, the shiny stuff on the site that isn't actually required. These little number one, number two things, that's not really required. This little guy right here, when we were developing these templates, we affectionately called this guy the pimple, kind of hang down, couldn't come up with a better name. That's kind of just doesn't really need to be there. I want to fix up this menu a little bit so I don't get this weird behavior where it's wrapping and stuff like that. So let's go ahead and see what I can do. Lucky for me, I'm going to go ahead and delete this. And I've got a bunch of stuff already here. So this is just a bunch of styles that I've gone through and applied to reset all of this stuff. I don't want to make you sit here and listen to me type all of these out, but I've got some stuff here. Wrong window. I run this guy. You can now see looks a little bit cleaner, right? I've kind of centered up the menu, put it underneath, removed some of the padding so that header is not as bad. I minutely spaced out the menu items a little bit more to give your thumb a little bit more space to click on them. That's something you should think about, because I hate when I go to websites that are mobile and I'm trying to click on it and the little click area is like 4 pixels. I've got fat fingers. Please make them bigger. I've removed all the ones and twos here that aren't needed. And if I keep scrolling down here, you know, that little pimple's gone and all the images are gone. You guys get the idea. And my scroll bar is a lot smaller now. Right? The user doesn't have to scroll through 800 pages worth of shiny stuff to get to what they care about. Right. Oh, and the footer looks a little bit cleaner as well. So I've effectively taken the same markup that I'm going to use in both places and supported a down-level browser experience. I'm using the example of a phone, but this could also be a down-level computer. Right. Several years ago, those little netbooks became very popular, or the little one PC, the ones where you would buy one and it would go to a third world country. I forget what they're called. OLPC, thank you. OLPCs, those were really cool, but they have really low resolution screens. So if you would try to view anything, you know, like a standard website on it, you would just end up scrolling back and forth about 800 times, right? That's a down-level experience that you may want to support, especially if your customer base is something that might be on a down-level support, right? So I want to go ahead and clean this up a little bit just so I can show off some flashiness. And in this particular case, if you can see, if I make it wider, I think it's 960 pixels, I lose that content. I don't really like that. I like things to look happy, shiny, new. I don't like that it just kind of disappears and everything moves around. I want to add some animations. The old way of doing that would be I'd open up a JavaScript file, I'd start typing some jQuery. I'd get really bored with all the jQuery stuff, and I'd run away screaming because I couldn't figure out why my thing was airing out or why the animations weren't doing the way I wanted them to. Luckily, we have some CSS3 stuff. So CSS3 also includes animations. So when I was talking about keyframes, you can define your own animation, right? So you can say my animation foo, and you define a bunch of keyframes. It's just like you would if you were animating, you know, an image, or if you're familiar with any kind of computer animation, you know, say at this point I want it to be this, at this point I want it to be this, and the computer interprets in between those points and gives you all the points in between so it can play a smooth animation. You can define your own that way, or there's some built-in ones that you can use. But in this case, I'm going to use just a couple here. So if I go ahead and find some stuff, I've got some code already here. The first one I'm going to show you is this is the main content. This is that little pimple guy, the little blue accent at the top. What I'm doing here is I'm defining transition. I'm saying what I want it to apply to. So on the background, anytime the background changes, I want you to do this transition. EaseIn, which is the algorithm it's going to use to calculate those in-between points, and the duration of 5 seconds, or 0.5 seconds. Sorry, 5 seconds would be a really long time. Half a second. So this is going to, anytime the background changes, it's going to fade one in, fade one out, or animate the transition, whatever. It needs to be a numerical value to do a transition, so it has to have a numerical representation, so a number. So padding, a position, a color is a numerical value, so you can use that. It's just a hex numerical value. You can use that as well. But the other thing I wanted to kind of point out here is you'll notice that I actually have 4 things, and some of them start with dash. This is what's called vendor prefixing. Very early on, CSS3 is still relatively new, first off. Very new. And it's not nearly as close to being ratified as HTML5 is. We already talked that HTML5 is still a little ways off. CSS3 is even further. The way that they've kind of done this is said, we're going to ratify that CSS3 has submodules and move on. So they ratified some stuff and said everything else is a submodule. We'll ratify each submodule individually, right? So as browsers wanted to support these things, they tried to say, I want to do some backwards compatibility, something like that. So they would do these vendor prefixings in front of the attribute. So it would do dash Mozilla, dash Opera is the dash O. Does anyone actually use Opera? Anyone? Okay, I still haven't found anyone that actually does, but apparently somebody does. WebKit, so like Safari, Chrome, any of those WebKit browsers. And then the other one, which is Transition, that's actually what the spec says it should be if it doesn't change. And IE doesn't use any vendor prefixing. It just uses the straight name. All the other ones use vendor prefixing. Once again, I'm not arguing for one or the other. I use Chrome on a daily basis, so take it or leave it. So if I go ahead and show you what this guy looks like now. So if I go ahead and go up to this little pimple and I make them smaller. Ooh, a little slidey animation as the once it gets past that point, the guy kind of slides over out of the way. So let's take this little step further now that you kind of know what's going on. Got two more animations that I'm going to add. In this particular case, I told you that I was using the background. So I was selectively saying any property that changes or this property that changes, apply this animation. In this particular case, I'm using the keyword all, which means if any property changes, apply this. Right, so it's a little bit easier to do. I could have also done comma and then started a new property. So you can say background, position, ease in 0.5 seconds, and you could do opacity, ease in 0.5 seconds. You could chain them as well. In this case, I'm changing several of them, and it was a little bit cleaner code to use the keyword all. And the last one. On this guy, all is well, everything slides over. If I show you these guys, they kind of do a little transparency and shrink themselves, changing the size of them. So that's kind of a very simple way that you can take something and you're using something simple to support a down-level browser, and you kind of zazzed it up, if you will, a little bit to put lipstick on the pig, if you will, to give your down-level user experience something a little bit better. Right, or maybe I want half my screen. One thing that really annoys me is on certain websites, if they're really large websites, and I want to be doing two things at once, and I make half of it, you know, half the screen, and the other half, my work stuff. YouTube is on half the screen. I want everything to kind of still look nice when it's half. So this is kind of a way that you can support that scenario. Any questions so far? Nope. Okay. So the last part. I want to continue talking on about how you can use new HTML5 stuff and support these down-level browsers. I talk a lot about down-level. The term I like to use is called graceful degradation. Several years ago, it became very popular to call it progressive enhancement. So if a browser supported something, you would tack on features afterwards. I found that very difficult. I like the newest, latest, and greatest tech. I'd rather design for the newest, latest, greatest in tech, and then just give a slightly less crappy experience to somebody that doesn't have the latest, greatest, newest tech. It's just the way I like to do it. So I like to call it graceful degradation. So I like to design new and support down-level. Part of the thing is, these are relatively trivial examples. But the example I'm going to show you next around WebSockets is something very, very, very far-reaching, and it's a complete change. So a WebSocket is two-level communication. Right? How do you support that on a down level that doesn't know how to do two-level communication? Everyone knows that HTML is stateless. You ask for something, the browser returns it and forgets who you are. You ask for something again, browser returns it, moves it back. There's no state. Different frameworks have faked state throughout time. You know, ASP.NET faked state by putting something called view state on the page. It's a serialization of all the state of your app put on the page, and then you send that back so we know where you were. How do you do that? Well, there are several things called, the term for this is called polyfills. So it's taking something and filling back in where the browser is missing. There's several of these. A very good polyfill might be jQuery UI, right? So there's a new date time type. So if you do input type equals date or date time, the spec says I should get a date time picker, right? So I should get a little date picker, or if I'm on daytime, I get a little date picker with a little clock next to it that I can choose the time, right? How would you support that on a browser that doesn't support it? Well, you would selectively turn these things on or off based on the browser support. You would go and find all of them, that find all the date time pickers and wire up the jQuery UI date picker, right? Luckily, one thing that I'm not going to have time to show you is a library called Modernizer. Modernizer is a very good library. It gives you the foundation for being able to use polyfills. In my resources slide, you'll see it. I'll stay after and show anyone that wants to see it. But it allows you to, when you include that JavaScript file, it starts querying the browser and says, hey, do you support this, 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 all of the HTML5 stuff? And then you can use JavaScript or some class styling against it to do what you want. So you can say, does this browser support date time? Right? You'll be able to read all those things in a nice, easy, bundled up way. It's a great library. It's really kind of the foundation. It makes using polyfills much, much easier. And I highly recommend it if you're going to go down that route. So the last thing I want to close on is the WebSockets demo. So for those that are not familiar with WebSockets, WebSockets is two-way communication. When the W3C started designing these specs, they realized there was all these kinds of applications that were doing two-way communication. Right? You were either being notified, you're watching ESPN.com, and you're being notified of the scores coming down all the time. Or you're watching a stock ticker app that's bringing in all the, you know, the stock prices. You're watching your certain company stocks stay the same for 4 years. But there was this need for two-way communication. And so they decided to define this spec called WebSockets, which allowed these two kind of two-level communication through without having to do all the underlying programming. There's a great JavaScript API for it, but it's quite difficult to use. It's socket communication. You're streaming binary data back and forth. It's quite difficult to actually use. It's not something that you might take on yourself, not something that you would normally jump to. So there's a great library out there created by some of my friends. I don't say it's just great because I know the people that created it, called SignalR. Has anyone heard of SignalR yet? Several people have, so you know what it is. They don't really market it as a polyfill, but I like to say that it is a polyfill. It allows you to create applications that do two-way communication, and it supports down-level browsers. So it's going to support IE. It's going to support a phone. It's going to support everything. But if you have the ability to do WebSockets, it's going to choose to do that for you. It's going to figure that all out for you. So I'm going to show you a very simple example. You might have seen this before if you've seen SignalR. It's a move shape demo. So I'm going to draw a shape on the screen, and I'm going to be able to move it around. So the first thing I want to do is SignalR, without going too much into it, has the idea of a hub. That's kind of the central point that everything talks to. That's the thing that exists on the server. On the server, you override hub, you give it a name. You're going to need to know that name because you're going to call it from JavaScript. Right? You're going to initiate this two-way communication back and forth. You're going to call this. And then you're going to give it a method. This method is whatever you want. You can put anything here. I could put another method. These are just methods that are going to be exposed to the clients. The clients are going to be able to call these guys. In this particular case, I'm going to say move shape, and I'm going to take an X and a Y position. So where do you want me to move this shape to? And then I'm going to get the client's collection. This comes from overriding the hub, right? So it knows all the clients that are connected to the hub. And I'm going to say find all of them. And then I am going to then call a method on the client side, right? So the client calls the server calls the client, right? It's two-way communication. I know that the client has this method, I'm going to call it. In this particular case, I'm sending down the ID of the connection and then also the position that you want to move. You'll see the ID of the connection. So I've got that guy. That's the first thing. Created a hub, just inherited, gave it a name, whatever methods I want it to do. This could be as simple as sending down some text that says, go refresh the page, or sending down the new score data. Right? So the new score of the basketball game is 59 to 49, whatever. Take your pick. So first off, I should mention how you get this library. This library is most easily gotten through NuGet. If you're in Visual Studio, you can right-click View Source, Manage NuGet Packages. This is going to go open up the NuGet Package Manager console, and it'll allow you to download the third-party tools or third-party libraries. It's basically like Ruby Gems for .NET. It's just a way to bundle up a bunch of code and send it down to the client. If you don't know, I can also speak to that later. So I've got it through there. Also, if you're not using .NET, sorry, this is a .NET only library. This is the one part of the talk that applies to .NET only. There are other libraries like this for PHP and those types of things. They're just not as cool as this. So on the index page, I've included jQuery because I don't know who writes JavaScript without using jQuery. I've included jQuery UI because I'm actually using that to allow me to drag the shape around the screen. I'm using the draggable. I've included the SignalR jQuery library. This is what hooks everything up, so SignalR knows I can call methods off of everything. And then, most interesting, I've included this last piece, which is the SignalR Hubs piece. The SignalR Hubs piece is a dynamically generated JavaScript file that's on the server that gets sent down. It's generated based on that hub that we just created, so it knows how to talk to that hub. So this will get generated and refreshed every time. And then lastly, I have my move shape, which we'll talk about in just a second. Very simple. I've done some horrible things by doing inline styling here on the page. But I have a style, and then I just have my shape that I care about. So if I go to my move shape JS, if everyone doesn't know this, I like to call this open resig in homage to John Resig. He's the guy that created jQuery. Everything kind of uses this pattern. It's just a document on load. So after the whole page is done loading, go execute this JavaScript so you can get everything, all the DOM nodes that are rendered. I'm going to go get the hub. So this allows me to go get the move shape hub. This comes from that dynamically generated JavaScript, right? So SignalR slash hub JavaScript, that's where this guy comes from. So I'm going to get the move shape hub. I'm going to find that shape on the page. I am going to do some, when I move that function, so when I move that shape, I'm going to call this method on the server that says, hey, I moved. You're notifying the server what happened, right? And in here, this is, by the way, this is just starting everything up. It needs to know to initiate the connection. So it won't actually start initiating the connection because WebSockets can be kind of expensive. It doesn't initiate the connection until you tell it to. It doesn't initiate it as soon as the page loads. So you got to call start, and then it gives you a callback. And then lastly, when the server calls move shape, this is what I want you to do, right? So on the client, I've created that move shape method, which took the ID and the X and Y position. You saw that here. So that's what I'm doing right here. I'm calling that method on the client. What I'm doing here is I'm just saying, hey, go get me the ID of my connection. And if I'm being notified about something that I caused, just ignore it, right? So if I've, don't move me again because I'm the one that was moving. And then I'm just going to move the CSS. So I'm just using some CSS to move it around the page. So I go ahead and run this guy. I'm going to open up this guy. And I can show you it's not really terribly exciting right now because I've only got one browser. So let me open up another browser. So I'm in IE10 mode. Let me open up that guy. Put these so you can see. So there is going to be some latency here, right? I'm on the local machine, so it's just orders of milliseconds, like 1 or 2 milliseconds to go up to the server and then back down. But even on the real thing, it's still going to be smooth because I'm sending every time the point moves, I'm animating that move, right? So it might be behind, but it's going to be smooth. You're not going to lose the frames effectively. So you can see here, I've got this going. So the part that's most interesting to me is this is using WebSockets, which I'm on a Windows 8 box, so I can use WebSockets. I'm going to switch to IE8. Does anyone think this is going to work? Any takers? Nope. Okay, so hey, look at that. Working on IE8. So what's going on behind the covers? If I go ahead and start capturing this guy, and let me open the network trace on this guy as well. Start capturing him right here. This guy. So in Chrome, a browser that supports WebSockets, I am now, let me just expand this out, I'm using the transport of a WebSocket for the Chrome browser that's connected, right? SignalR did this. It figured it out. It figured out, hey, this browser supports WebSockets. I'm going to use WebSockets to talk from the client to this server. But if I come over here and I go to this guy, I'm going to use a transport called ForeverFrame. You might be familiar with this. Basically, what this is the browser sends a request to the server, and the server just holds on to that request until it has some data and then returns it back. And then the client issues a new one, and it holds on to it until it gets some data and the returns. It's called ForeverFrame. It's a standard way, and that's how most things right now get around not having two-way communication. There's a third fallback mechanism that it will use. Some browsers won't support that ForeverFrame, or it'll time out after a certain state. The third one is just it will switch to a polling mechanism. So every like 10 seconds, it's configurable. I think it's every 10 seconds it will just pull out and ask the server for some new data. Right. So this is a great example of how I've taken something that is new, shiny, and great, and brought it back down, been able to use it in my day-to-day work, and also supported all those old browsers that I have to support every day. Right? Jump back to this guy. So with that, I threw a bunch of resources at you. Modernizer, I mentioned before. It's Modernizer spelled the cool hip way, which is without an E. The cool hip way is now without an E. HTML5 test is a really cool site that you can visit. You visit it on your browser. It's going to list off all the compatibilities that your browser has. It's really cool. I've used it a couple times. My TV has a built-in browser, and I kind of was curious what kind of HTML support it had. So I just navigated to HTML5, saw all the support that it needed. There's the resources for the HTML5 spec. Obviously, you might be hesitant to go look at the spec. Specs are normally pretty nasty. It's actually pretty easy to read. It's not really that big and scary. Don't worry about it. If you're confused, go read the spec. I highly recommend it. And then lastly is HTML5labs.com. It has basically all the HTML5 functionality. There's a bunch of labs for each one. You can kind of run through and get an idea of all of what's supported now. And then lastly, to finish up, I'm osbornm.com, and then that's my username on everything. So with that, I'm a little over time, but I started a little late, so thank you, guys.